Lecture number 2. And last time we were together, we talked a great deal about a variety of coherent states. Today I want to focus on some physical uses and association of these states. So, physics of the coherent states and classical and quantum mechanics. So this will be a good review for you of such topics. The Schrödinger eigenstates of the position operator, capital Q, acting on ket x, giving eigenvalue x and ket x again. Clearly the dimensions of Q are the same as the dimensions of x. The physics of that x variable as a label, the physics of that is, it is the position. It tells you the sharp position. The Heisenberg partner operator, the momentum operator, acting on the state with a K label, it gives its own eigenvectors and eigenvalues. Again, the dimensions are the same, the physics is the same. This means this is the sharp momentum. That's the story for the regular Q's and P's. Let's turn that into an inquiry, a question of what it is for the going to be for the coherent state. What are the physical meaning of the labels P and Q that we have here? So we'll introduce our unitary transformation. This is a form of the Weyl operator. Little P and little Q again are C numbers. Capital Q and capital P are operators. These people who come in should pass papers. I don't see. You have to be in charge of that over there. Somebody. Well, at least in the corner. You have, but all right. Okay. So if I act on the operator P with U on one side and the adjoint on the other side, it acts to translate the P plus little p. I put down a Y here. For the students among you who wish to verify that, that's an important kind of relationship. Same question could be asked about the capital Q, and that translates to Q. In my opinion, these are the two most important signs, S-I-G-N-S, of the problem. I'm getting those both as plus, and that dictates the two signs up here, this one being a minus and that one being a plus. Now, let those operators U act on a general arbitrary fiducial vector normalized, however, and we'll define that as our coherent states, and then we can take the coherent state matrix, diagonal matrix element of the operator P, and this machinery will tell us straight away that we get the number P right out of there, and because these are unit vectors and normalized, and then we get the expectation value of the operator P in the fiducial vector. The same thing for the operator Q. Diagonal expectation value in the coherent states gives us little q but plus this expectation value. So here we begin to see the use of putting on a few simple criteria on our fiducial vector. Let's arrange it so that the expectation value of capital P and the expectation value of Q are both zero. That's easy. If you take the Schrödinger representation and you take a real, even function, then we'll have the property, the even will take care of this, and the reality will take care of this. And I'll call that physically centered. That means these two terms are out of that. And I've put in the box down here the very important fact that the diagonal coherent state matrix element of the capital operator P is little p, the same for capital Q being little q. So the meaning, I emphasize, the meaning of P and Q of the coherent state labels is that they are the mean values of the operators, not at all the sharp eigenvector values that we have in the traditional case. How does that go when we talk about another operator? Let's imagine that script H here was the Hamiltonian for some system in question. It depends on the operators P and Q. We take its diagonal matrix elements. We'll call that quantity capital H of PQ here, as on the left. Using these transformations up here, we can transform that to the question of the expectation value in the fiducial vector of the translated operator, capital P plus little p, capital Q plus little q. Think of this as a polynomial. There's a term in this polynomial which is full power of little p and full power of little q. For example, if this was a square, just p squared, there would be a term little p squared, there would be a cross term, and there would be a capital P squared term. The little p squared term is something that comes out straight away here. That is the original functional form here, now evaluated for the C numbers, p and q. And what's left behind will have at least one or more of these operators involved. And I will claim that that can be made to be small, order of each bar. Of course, it still depends on p and q left over. And the smallest criteria is provided I choose, in addition to my physical centering here, that the expectation value, for example, of the combination p squared plus q squared is itself small. You recognize that as basically the Hamiltonian, twice the Hamiltonian for the harmonic oscillator. You know that in the ground state of that's h bar itself. So here's an example where that'd be done. But even the third excited state or some finite linear combination of those states would also have this part. We'll call this Hamiltonian here an h-bar augmented classical Hamiltonian. It has all the properties of classical Hamiltonian. If this was a positive operator, that would be a positive function, for example. It just means that h-bar has not been set equal to zero. If you want, you can also ask the question, what happens in the limit that h-bar goes to zero? That bar, that O of h-bar term disappears, and you're left with that function left over. That's the, if you call it, the true classical limit. But let's talk about this h-bar augmented situation as a possibility, and at the end of today's lecture, I'll give you an example where that can actually make a difference. We're going to interpret, therefore, p's and q's as variables in a classical phase space. So here is our picture. We have a classical phase space over here, script M. We have a particular point in here. Forget the p and the q for the moment. Point. And we're going to map that into our Hilbert space, into a vector, a ket over here. Forget the p and the q in the moment. Just think that that's blank. So that point is being mapped into that vector. We'll put down coordinates in a moment here. The coordinates are coming up. The coordinates to label that point, p and q, and what else will we call it? We'll call that vector the vector labeled by the same symbols, p and q. We've seen this kind of picture before, but here is particularly applied to the phase space of classical mechanics. Here is a two-dimensional sheet in Hilbert space on which the coherent states labeled by p and q sit. In classical mechanics, you often deal with a change of coordinates from one set of canonical coordinates to another set. Let's imagine we have p bar, this is not the complex conjugate, p bar and q bar as two new canonical coordinates, and they are functions of the old coordinates here. And what is the connection of those? I hope you perhaps remember this from your classical mechanics. It's the differential p dq can be re-expressed in terms of p bar and dq bar plus what's called a generator, d of f bar. That's a generator of the canonical transformation connecting the old and the new set of coordinates. Likewise, I can rephrase this term on the right side if I wish. Instead of having q bar and q as the independent variables, I can pretend that q here is a function of the variables p bar and q bar, and so I get something new over here, a new function of the p bar and the q bar. So all the p bar, q bar are on this side, all the pqs are on that side. The natural beauty of this connection between two sets of canonical transformations is built in that you get automatically the Liouville formula conserved that the volume element in phase space is the same. Now, here we went from old coordinates to new coordinates. We can also go backwards. We can go from new coordinates, p bar and q, to back to the old coordinates. Here they are here. Q, a function q of these would give us the q of there. So that's the clue for how we're going to define the coherent states in the new coordinates. We take the original vector, pq, which we mapped here to here. we re-express the symbol P and the symbol Q in terms of their new coordinate form, and then by definition, we call that P bar Q bar. The Dirac notation is wonderful, absolutely wonderful. But if I give you this vector, you know precious little about what it means. 17 what? Is this the position vector number, the momentum number, the number of the number state number, for example? It doesn't tell you that. So I'm following in that standard mode of tolerated ambiguity and letting the new symbol, P bar, Q bar, stand for the same symbol as before. Here in the sense of maps is the way to look at that. Here's our original phase space, and I've crisscrossed in the two colors here the coordinates P and Q, and we have, therefore, this particular point of interest is at the point P and Q of that, and that's mapped over into the Hilbert space, and that's what gives the vector its name. Over here, I've given a different set of coordinates on the same phase space. P bar Q bar is the name of the point which labels that, and that's mapped into the same vector, therefore the vectors are the same. Okay. I've talked several times, and I like this picture. I can only draw this one kind of sheet, so they're all going to look like this. The sheet is a surface, here two-dimensional. If I had four parameters to my coherent state, it would be a four-dimensional surface, if you will, in the Hilbert space. But that such a surface has its own intrinsic geometry, and it's very interesting and useful to talk about that. We're going to have two kinds of geometry related to the coherent states. One is called symplectic geometry, and the other is called Riemannian geometry. Riemannian geometry, you're more used to. It's a little bit closer to Euclid and Pythagoras than other forms. So let's talk about the symplectic geometry we can ascribe to the sheet in the Hilbert space. I introduced something called a symplectic potential, which is the differential of the coherent state. Take the inner product with the coherent state again, and then multiply by I to make it a real quantity, and H bar to give it some dimensions. Okay, so let's calculate that out. Here are the coherent states of interest. This is the operation D. This is the IH bar. Differential on this is to one of those. That brings down a minus I DQ times a capital P divided by H bar. The H bars cancel. The DQ stays there, the capital P, and the I times the minus I gives us a plus sign. So we have this net combination of the D operation acting on the coherent state. Okay, so now we complete the process by taking the inner product with the coherent state itself. A certain unitary operator has disappeared. This is all that's left. We know how to take this unitary and this adjoint acting on that. That simply translates the P to little p. DQ minus QDP, what we have out of that is a PDQ from here, with the unit vector giving us just a multiplier of 1, and then we have the expectation value of capital P times DQ, and minus the expectation value of capital Q times DQ. Now, both of these are numbers, so this is a PDQ plus a constant times DQ, plus another constant, if you will, times DP. That's a perfectly acceptable one form, but let's choose it a little bit more physically. When we talked about the physically centered choice of eta, that meant that this average was zero and this average was zero, so we came down straight away now to our one form being PDQ. PDQ. We've seen that before in our canonical coordinate transformations. This will become a very important connection. I want you to associate in your mind here, this is quantum mechanics over here, but this is an ingredient in symplectic potential familiar from the concepts of classical phase space. A little more familiar to you, as I say, is Riemannian geometry, but it will be a little bit distant from you, the kind of result we get. Let's talk first about a little background. Let's let psi and phi be two unit vectors in the Hilbert space. A traditional distance of measure, a traditional measure of distance here, d squared, between two vectors in a Hilbert space is simply the length of the distance between them. It's just a regular Euclidean kind of distance elevated to the status of Hilbert space. Square that out, you get psi times psi, but that's a unit vector. Phi times phi, that's a unit vector. That's this picture of that too. And then you get the cross term of each in the each order, psi with phi and phi with psi, and that amounts to twice the real part of psi phi, which you take away. So that's the distance, if you will, between two unit vectors in Hilbert space, standard story. The physics, however, in Hilbert space does not reside in the vectors, but in the rays. The rays are the collection of vectors and all their phase vectors. So let's take a distance, which is a ray distance between these two otherwise vectors, and we do that simply by putting in a phase factor, e to the I alpha times the phi, and we're going to minimize that over all possible alphas. For example, let's take two vectors up here in the original distance, which had the same form. Each was the same except for the phase vector. So they would actually have a finite positive distance between them because one vector and the other vector with a different phase vector, hard for me to draw a phase vector, but you have to understand, a different phase vector here gives me a positive distance. But down here, if I look in the ray distance, whatever the phase factor here, I can look for the minimum of that. And if these were the same, apart from that phase factor, the minimum distance would be zero. Okay, so that's where the physics lies. That's a more physical distance among two unit vectors in Hilbert space. And you can see how that works out. If I put this phase factor in here, that's an e to the I alpha here. And as I run alpha around, the maximum I can make that term, that is the minimum of this combination, is to make this quantity here the absolute magnitude of the inner product of psi and phi. Okay, so that's a mathematical prescription of the ray distance between the two arbitrary unit vectors in Hilbert space. Decompose this into its real and imaginary parts, and then you're free to take the absolute magnitude term. That looks what this is. Rather complicated line down here is. And then we're going to specialize to nearby vectors. Psi is equal to 5 plus 8 infinitesimal vector, d phi. But that's a unit vector, and that's a unit vector. So you got to be careful about that. That means that phi d phi, complex conjugate, is actually minus phi d phi. Bring this to the other side here, and that would be a simple statement, the fact that phi inner product with phi is unity, and so the differential of that has to be zero. Okay, so put this information in here, and you come down to this for the infinitesimal distance between two vectors, nearby vectors in the ray metric, and that's d phi magnitude squared minus phi d phi absolute squared. Again, notice if phi was a pure phase change that we make in the d, so this differential is proportional to phi, then it's going to cancel out of this, so the distance is still zero. Finally, let's apply it to our coherent states, PQ, and multiply by 2h bar for friendship and convenience, and this will call that our metric in phase space, induced by the coherent states. Well, what is it? to make the computation or the notation a little simpler, let's take the expectation value of an operator in the fiducial vector, just to be angle A, angle here. Here's our definition of our choice of canonical coherent states, and here is the answer for the metric. There's a multiplier here. dp squared times a constant, which happens to be the expectation value of q squared. dp dq times the constant, which is the expectation of pq plus qp. dq squared times the expectation value of p squared. That's a constant, that's a constant, that's a constant. So everything is a constant multiplier of differentials. And if you remember your differential geometry, your metric business, this means this is a flat space. For those of you who remember Christoffel symbols, you take a derivative of the metric coefficients, well, all these derivatives vanish. So you're in flat space. We're in flat space for any choice of eta. That means the flat space is being dictated by the group, the Weyl operators, the Weyl group, and having nothing to do with the choice of eta. Only the particular coordinate choice here, the coefficients, comes from the eta. Indeed, if we take an eta equal to the harmonic oscillator ground state, namely it's the state whose with the annihilation operator equal to zero on that, then this choice of coefficients leads us to d sigma squared equal to dp squared plus dq squared. Very nice, very clean, very convenient. Cartesian coordinates. Cartesian coordinates can only exist in flat space. The coherent states have given to the classical phase space a metric. Okay. Geometry in different coordinates. Suppose I change from our friends P and Q to our other friends P bar and Q bar, a different set of canonical coordinates. Well, we've already seen what dp dq, that was our one form before, that becomes p bar dq bar plus dg of p bar q bar. That was the definition of the connection between one set of coordinates and another. And the metric in the new coordinates, well, it will have coefficients now no longer in general constants, a function of p bar and q bar multiplying the dp squared, another function multiplying the dp dq, another function multiplying the dq bar squared. Not necessarily constants, but still a flat space. You cannot change the nature underlying the space that is flat just by a change of coordinates. Okay. Quantum mechanics has given a metric to classical phase space. When you study classical physics, classical mechanics, you never talk about a metric on phase space. You only talk about a symplectic form. You may not remember the symplectic form, but you should remember that you've never heard the word metric associated with classical phase space. But that's what quantum mechanics does. Okay. For canonical variables, the kinematics of the quantum theory, which I say canonical, I mean P and Q, the Heisenberg type of variables, the result is a flat space, a flat space. My goodness, what about other quantum variables other than the P and Q? What about other sets of coherent states? I try to put such drama into my talk, but you've all got the answers right in front of you. Isn't it really as profound as it's working out? Let's talk about the spin coherent states. You remember those? They had the maximal weight vector, maximal spin eigenvector, the third component of the spin variables here, and e to the minus I theta S2, e to the minus I phi S3. There's no H bar. These are pure constants. And theta and phi is the name of our coherent state. So we put that into our formula for the one form, and we come out with S, the magnitude of spin, H bar, which we put in, times cosine theta times d phi. That is our one form associated to the spin coherent states. Well, it doesn't look very canonical. It's not PDQ or ADB or FDG or something. But we can fix that easily. Let's introduce canonical variables. P is equal to square root of SH bar, square root of that, times cosine theta, and a little q will be square root of SH bar times phi. And when we do that, then the one form in the new variables, the canonical variables, is PDQ, friendly version. What about the metric? We had a formula on the previous one or two transparencies, which gave us the metric. We had multiplied by 2H bar, and then this form that we found from the Ray metric, etc. And now all we have to do is plug in our definition for the new coherent state into that formula, and we'll come out with a metric given as follows: S times H bar times d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. I use those coordinates theta and phi deliberately because you recognize that metric. It's a metric of a sphere, a two-sphere. What is the radius of that sphere? Well, this is r squared in front of it, so the radius has to be square root of sh bar. So we have a sphere. Let me be a sphere for a moment. In phase space with quantized radii. As S changes from 1/2 to 1 to 3/2, etc., then the radius itself will change of the sphere. There is no intermediate sphere in the geometry that coherent states give to the classical phase space in this particular case. We can also ask about the form of the metric in our canonical coordinates, P and Q, just a coordinate change from the thetas and phi, and that has the version dP squared divided by 1 minus P squared over SH bar plus 1 minus P squared SH bar times dQ squared. So this is certainly not clearly, this is clearly not Cartesian coordinates, but I would say, venture to say, it's not clear to you that that's a sphere right away, so it's much more useful to introduce, to keep those other coordinates as well. Let's talk about the affine coherent states. Affine coherent states was associated with a family of operators when capital Q has to be positive. And we found that it was not appropriate to take capital P, the Heisenberg conjugate associated with that, because that doesn't generate unitary transformations. We need the dilation operator, which is simply PQ plus QP divided by 2. Capital Q will carry no dimensions. P will carry all the dimensions of H bar. So natural log of little q is okay. Q is a positive number, and it has no dimensions, so that's okay. And P and Q net carry dimensions H bar, so that cancels that. Anyway, this is the name of our coherent states, and of course, if I didn't tell you by this definition, you couldn't tell the difference between that symbol and the coherent states for the Heisenberg, because it looks the same. That's Mr. Dirac giving his one of his little jokes from history. In any case, let's take our affine coherent states and put in our one form, the symplectic one form, and you get out of this general formula, you again get PDQ. And that's the purpose of, if you will, to get that form, to have this very, very, very version here. I could have had Q inverse here. I could have had a plus in front of that or something. That could have been an alternative variation here, or log of Q squared could have been another parameterization. But no, I wanted to get out PDQ, and that's the form that they gave it to me. And the metric? The metric in this case is given by this formula. There was a beta. A beta, if you recall, was one of our variables in the finding of the extremal state. If you look for a Gaussian solution to the minimum uncertainty problem, you will have a one-parameter family. You will have the width of the Gaussian as a parameter here. Here we have a kind of a width parameter as well. So that's our beta here. beta h bar to the minus 1. We need that because this is supposed to have dimensions h bar. P carries all the dimensions here as h bar squared, so I have to cancel one of those. And here's a beta h bar over here and a q inverse squared dq squared. And this is a very small variation of the standard coordinates for the Poincaré plane, so-called. And don't forget q is always positive here. A so-called pseudosphere. While this was a space of constant positive curvature up here for this spherical situation, in the pseudosphere this is a situation of constant negative curvature. So we have had flat space, we've had a sphere which is constant positive curvature, and now we have constant negative curvature. And exercise. It's a little more serious than the ones I've given you before, the whys and the what fors. You remember we had a family of coherent states which were non-group defined. They had the little coefficients rho n, and we made a moment problem that was at the end of our previous lecture. So I ask you to find the one form and the metric, form of the infinitesimal metric, on this non-group structure. And if you cared to pursue it, you would find it leads to a two-dimensional surface of non-constant curvature. Non-constant curvature. There's no symmetry. Well, reduced symmetry in this surface, and that is connected with the fact that there's no symmetry group with it. Okay, now I would like to ask questions. I would like to get answers, but I don't expect answers from Stoic Norwegians, so I will have to provide my own answers, perhaps. I want to recall the great beauty and joy that we have action principles in physics, and in particular in classical mechanics. I will call capital I sub C integrated from 0 to capital T PQ dot minus H PQ DT. I call that a classical action. You vary that over infinitesimal changes of the paths. You hold certain boundary conditions fixed, and you demand that that variation equals 0. And from that, you derive the equations of motion. Very powerful mathematics, very powerful symbolism, actually. Nothing new, I hope, for you. So I'm going to vary that. That means I vary the little p guy. So there's a p coefficient here times the q dot. Then the variation of this quantity with respect to p is the derivative with respect to p times dp. Carry that forward with the dqs. Here is the variation of dq. But to expose the dq, I integrate by parts. That gave me a surface term at the endpoints, not an integral, but a surface term, 0 to cap t of p dq. And I'm supposed to hold the path q of 0 fixed, q of t fixed, so that would be 0. Then I insist it to be 0, therefore, since the dp and the dq were arbitrary, then I have the two traditional Hamilton equations of motion. No surprises. I ask you, as a slight build-up to a more complicated or a challenging question, suppose I take situation number 2, where my action is given by minus qp dot, not pq dot, but minus qp dot. I claim the answer is pretty straightforward. I would vary this, and I'd have to have a surface term that looked like minus q variation p between 0 and t. I'd have to set that 0. That means I would have to hold the p fixed at time 0 and the p fixed at time capital T. Okay, that's an easy one to swallow. What about number 3? Number 3 is I have a half pq dot minus qp dot. I've taken an average, if you will, of the two preceding initial terms, minus h. I vary that. I get the two standard terms, which will give me Hamilton's equation. But I get two surface terms. one from the variation of Q and one relative to the variation of dP between 0 and t. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to set equal to 0? What do they tell you? Tell me, student, a student, one student, what did your teacher tell you? Thank you for the response. Did he say set Q equal to 0 at 0 and capital T and set P equal to 0 at capital 0 and capital T? I'll bet you 100 kronas he did not say that. And why didn't he say that? Because if you specify your path by giving the initial Q and the initial T, you specified the path. You're done. Because you can't freely specify the path at capital T of Q and capital and P. Little Q at capital T and P at capital T. You can't do that. Over-specification. That's what they would say. I say they're wrong. They're crazy. You can specify as much as you want. There may be no solution to the equation consistent with your specification. But their argument, oh, is if I specify just the Q's alone, I will have a solution because two data are needed, the initial coordinate and velocity, typically, but initial coordinate and final time might work. But of course, that is not necessarily unique either. If you take the harmonic oscillator and go half a period, starting at the origin, you will always return to the origin. So no matter how big your path is, you will always go there. So if you chose my Q of 0 here to be 0, and my Q at this capital time, this is not the period of what we're talking about, to be 3 up here, you would not find any solution at all to your harmonic oscillator problem that satisfied those conditions where my T happened to be the period of the problem divided by 2. Contrary-wise, if I set this to be 0, I would find infinitely many solutions to the problem that satisfied this and this. So maybe generally there is one solution, but it is not by any means always unique. Okay. Go one step further. Let's take P, Q dot plus G dot of P and Q. Capital G is my generator, like of canonical coordinate transformations. That would be part of the problem had I changed from one system of coordinates to the other system of coordinates. I would have had to deal with that. What am I supposed to hold fixed? I say the same situation is true here. In fact, you can go from this one to this one by a suitable capital G in here. In any case, don't be afraid to hold more. And for heaven's sakes, pass that on to your students. Not the older people there too resistant to change, but the young people when you get a chance. Okay, let's do another familiar action. Investigate it the same way. This is the quantum action. So we're in Hilbert space. So I sub capital Q, Q for quantum. So I have a bra and a ket, depending on time. And I put this operation in between, a derivative with respect to time, minus the Hamiltonian operator. Integrate that from time from 0 to capital T. That's another action function, perhaps an action functional at this point. Indeed, I can write it in terms of wave functions by putting in the x representation, if you will, here. Psi of x and t for this function, psi star x and t for this function. Here's the time derivative. Here's the element acting on h. Integrate over the x. That takes care of the Hilbert space norm. Integrate over time. That's our same integration as before. I want to get Schrödinger's equation out of this. So I vary this quantum action functional with respect to its variables. I tell you, or I ask you, what are the variables here? We had P and Q before in our classical mechanics. Two variables, P and Q, were varied independently. If I combine Q and P in a complex combination, Q plus IP divided by a constant equal to Z, Q minus IP divided by the same constant, C star, I've just gone from two real variables, Q and P, to two complex variables, Z and C star. And I can always go backwards. I can say that Z plus Z star divided by 2 is proportional to Q, etc. So if I had two variables before, Q and P, I claim I still have two variables, Z and C star. And they can be treated as independent. So, with that blazoned into your mind, let's look at our quantum action and vary the variables to get the equation of motion. I claim we can vary psi star straight away. There's one here, there's one there. That gives us this coefficient, which will become your familiar Schrodinger equation. We vary psi, which is the other variable in this problem, and we have to do an integration by parts, but that will expose the complex conjugate, if you will, of Schrodinger's equation. And we have that integration by parts term. The spatial integration survives, but we have the time at the initial time and the final time. So what are we supposed to specify here? Clearly, we have to specify a vanishing, or a fixed, rather, fixed psi at time 0 and a fixed psi at time capital T. Do you see an alternative to that? I take silence as a response of no alternative. But you know that Schrodinger's equation, which is right here, is completely given to you by psi initial time. You are not free to specify psi at two different times and get that. So this is an overspecification of what you'll need for the solution, but it is perfectly appropriate to get the equation of motion. My choice of overspecification here will not give you always a solution. There will be sometimes no solution. But if the final value psi of t is arranged properly with psi of 0, I will always have a solution. I will never find myself in the situation, never find myself in the situation up here where I had no solution at all to those equations. Okay, that's a little philosophy. Now, this is worth the price of admission right here, ladies and gentlemen. We have two very different action principles of physics. We have the classical action we talked about, integral PQ dot minus Hamiltonian. The arguments are P of T and Q of T. And we have the action associated to quantum mechanics, where the argument is a function, psi of x and t. So it would seem that we have two completely disconnected action principles for physics. I say no. Let's take the quantum action, top of the board. No. And restrict its possible variations. Restrict it not to arbitrary unit vectors in the Hilbert space, but to a select subset, which are the coherent states. So psi of t is restricted to my favorite little sheet in the Hilbert space, P of t and Q of t. What do I get? I take the quantum action functional, substituting only in the allowed family of vectors PQ that has this functional form. PQ, d by dt, PQ, that's exactly the kind of equation we had right up here. And we come straight away from here. I've just restricted what the function can be, here it is here, and here it is here. And what do I get? Well, you're ready. You've been primed for this point. PQ is a PDQ. Divide by DT, that becomes PQ dot. There it is, PQ dot. And what's over here is the Hamiltonian function. Okay, it's H-bar augmented. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But the classical action, ladies and gentlemen, is, capital is, underlined is, restricted form of quantum action. Does that make any physical sense? I say yes. If I'm an experimenter, and I pretend today I will be a classical experimenter, then I'm not allowed to look deep inside my atom. I will regard my atom as a point particle. I'm not allowed to penetrate its structure. So I am looking at it from far away at a classical macroscopic version. What can I do with it? What can I as an experimenter do with it? It's a point particle. I can't do much with it. I can't rotate it and say that it's any different at all. I can put it in another location. I could change its position, or I could change its velocity. That's all I can do to it as a classical experimenter. P and Q are the only possible states that I would have access to at the classical level to probe what is inherently a quantum problem. And therefore, it is not surprising that what I get out of that is the classical description of what I'm talking about. Okay. Let's pursue this question of H-bar augmented. What does it mean? Well, suppose this was a polynomial and we're dealing with canonical coherent states. So capital P and capital Q are our kinematical quantum variables. Then H, P, and Q is also a polynomial. Its leading term will be purely P and purely Q alone. Then there will be something proportional to capital P expectation value and correspondingly a lower monomial of P itself. So the lower order terms in this polynomial will be H-bar assisted or H-bar modified. Typically, they will be tiny corrections to this, and you actually in 100% minus epsilon, we'll get to the epsilon in a minute, of the experiments that you can do or the things you encounter in daily life, these H-bar corrections are so tiny you don't see them, therefore we do neglect them. We can neglect them. But I want to show you an example where you can't neglect it. Here's a classical Hamiltonian we can talk about. H sub C for classical, P squared over 2m, free particle, minus E squared over Q. We'll restrict ourselves to be Q positive, so we're on the half line. It's kind of like a hydrogen atom, a one-dimensional hydrogen atom. The energy is this function of P and Q at a constant value, and this energy could be both positive and negative, zero. And if I tell you that every solution with negative energy means that the particle cannot escape too far to the positive side because then that would become a positive number, it will eventually come backwards and strike the origin. So there's a singularity. It always, every solution with negative energy will have a singularity. Okay, let's take the quantum Hamiltonian. So we promote little p to an operator, capital Q to an operator. Again, we're doing the capital Q greater than zero story. So when we talk about the coherent states here, we have to be talking about the affine coherent states. Same philosophy carries through again. So we now discuss the H-bar augmented theory. H-bar is not going to zero. And we get that by taking the diagonal coherent state matrix elements with the affine coherent states of our Hamiltonian. The affine coherent states involve the variables in a different way. Instead of pure translation. This one is translated, but the little Q guy, remember the logarithm of Q, he comes in scaling variables. Capital Q gets image to little q times capital Q. Capital P gets image to capital P divided by Q. So this is the expectation value eta of the quantity which is going to become our h-bar augmented classical Hamiltonian. Here's a term which is p squared over 2n. That's our standard story we would like this to have. Here is a term which is e squared divided by little q times an eta q inverse eta. Now, eta has still not been chosen. I can choose this as I like. The only thing we ever once put on it was that its expectation value of q upstairs was plus 1. But I can make this close to 1 as I like. So here's an approximation sign. Let's neglect small h-bar corrections to that and call that minus e squared over q. There's that term here. There's this here, this elephant in the room that we can't get rid of. This is a non-vanishing expectation value of p squared. The expectation of the cross term that disappeared. So that's eta p squared over n. Remember for the affines that q was dimensionless, the capital P carried all the dimensions of h bar. So this term, whatever it is proportional to h bar squared. Each p has an h bar, so p squared has an h bar squared. We have h bar squared divided by 2m. I put in an e squared and an e squared in this formula and separated out one of the q's. This term here looks e squared over q looks exactly like that. But what's here in this term here then must be dimensionless. This has all the right dimensions for the energy. So this must be dimensionless. That means that h bar squared over m e squared must be a length. To kill the length of q, a0 over q. And that a0 is exactly your Bohr radius. That's the definition of the Bohr radius, h bar squared over m e squared. So now you'll see in the new augmented form, you have something which is an h bar squared correction to it, but it makes a huge difference for tiny, tiny q. Here, the q was so attractive that every solution had a singularity, but now you have a 1 over q squared with a positive sign, although with a small coefficient, but now all of the classical singularities are removed. So that's an example of how a very tiny correction term can nevertheless make its qualitative change in the problem. That concludes our lecture for today. And we will...